Committee on Trade and Economic Development to order.
How's it going?
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2011, and we have Mr. Marty Brantley, who would like to go first to testify. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me. I'm Marty Brantley, chairman of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I appreciate the speakers and the chair's interest in helping our department refocus our efforts. As I've continually tried to state to everybody who will listen, that I view this as a five-pronged reorganization, if you will. One is to identify our mission and to make sure that everybody understands that. The second is to make sure that the structure reflects what our mission should be. The third is to have the right people in place after you get the structure. The fourth is the money side of it all. And the fifth is the accountability. And so we are well on our way, I think, right now to achieving many of those goals as we move forth. And it is very appropriate that we address House Bill 2011 right now. During my time on the governor's transition team, I became very aware of the need to refocus our agency and have as its number one function the creation of quality, sustainable jobs. The Oregon Business Plan, the governor's GROW plan, the speaker's Economic Development Task Force all agree that this is the direction that we have to go. As a director, we've already initiated many changes in the department. As I indicated, that five-pronged scheduling is well in place, and they include the emphasis on business development. Most and more of our work must be focused on business recruitment and retention and expansion of our current businesses in order to create the jobs Oregon needs now as we grow into the future. The requested budget that we have reflects all this, too. We must also improve the accountability for all of our programs, and they must have a clear link between our programs and job creation. There's many different facets of that, including the workforce that is also being discussed. But we hear loud and clear what must be done, and we all understand that. This refocus will place greater importance on regional development officers who are stationed around the state. They are the department's lead business development staff in the region. So increased attention will also be given to the industries that drive the economies of these particular regions, too. To accomplish this refocus while keeping the department's budget lean, we are streamlining the process to reduce the number of people needed for our infrastructure projects and have significantly reduced our central support staff, too. So to the many elements of HB 2011, they appear to codify the department's changing direction, and we support that as amended, and we support the bill. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Brantley? Representative March.
Mr. Brantley, are you speaking to House Bill 2001, the dash ones, or the dash twos?
I'm sorry. I think I'm speaking to 2011. And is that your question? I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
There's dash one and dash two, and I think he's asking which ones.
Sure. Okay, dash two.
Thank you very much.
I didn't know there were two versions.
Yeah, so okay. Dash ones I was a little upset with.
Any other questions for Mr. Brantley before he leaves? Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me and expediting my presentation.
All right. Have a safe trip.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Bruce Anderson, who maybe can explain the dash twos to us in detail. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Anderson with the House Speaker's Office. I appreciate you accommodating Mr. Brantley's schedule. He had to depart early, so we thought it would be best to accommodate his busy schedule and then the rest of us can follow.
Okay.
I've appreciated the input from the committee from the last hearing. We've taken those comments, I believe, and worked with the department and others to accommodate the concerns that had been raised at the last meeting. What this bill is designed to do, let me say at the outset, is to help the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department fulfill its mission in serving the people of this state with economic development and, in turn, our local communities. We all know where the state has been economically these last couple of years now. And the bill, as amended, would seek to help counter those trends by helping existing businesses stay or expand their operations or bring new business in Oregon, helping to foster a climate of openness to business, laying out the welcome mat, if you will, helping businesses deal with rules and regulations so there's a better sense of certainty in our business project approval process. House Bill 2011, as amended, will not solve all of the problems the state is facing, but it's a way for the department to better assist businesses remain or expand in Oregon and bring new businesses and jobs to our state. It's to help the department in that regard. So taking the comments and concerns that were raised at the last hearing, what we have is a bill that's designed to refocus the OECD's mission on job and business retention, expansion, and recruitment, provide for better service delivery and help from the state's Economic Development Department to make that happen, engage the economic development-related state commissions in discussing and helping to improve our state's economy, as well as making recommendations on bringing certainty to the development process in the state, and encouraging local hiring by companies using the Strategic Investment Program, and finally, keeping the state legislature and the governor better updated on the activities of the state's Economic Development Department. So let me begin by saying that the portions of the bill that generated the concern the last time have been deleted, namely the projects of economic well-being, the supersiting provisions, if you will, the strategic investment program changes. That way, the things on another bill, House Bill 2299, I believe is currently in Ways and Means, can proceed without us having to worry about any conflicting language there. And specific language on the department's organization. The language as LC drafted in the -1 was a bit too prescriptive, so that was taken out. So the language we kept, but we made with some changes are as follows. In section, we did delete a couple of items that were related to those two other deletions I noted earlier in the whereas language. Secondly, in section 1, under the OECD mission, we added, you'll see a sub 5 on lines 22 and 23, so that underscores what the department is currently doing in their assistance to communities with economic development. In section 3 of the bill, you'll notice that the Environmental Quality Commission and LCDC chairs were taken out of that governor's council, with the Board of Agriculture chair and the chair of the International Trade Commission inserted there. And I think the thought there was that these other two entities are very much economically related. I believe that was brought up at the last hearing as well, and match well with the other commissions that are listed, while the other two are really regulatory agencies. And then in sub G on line 9, the governor has been given flexibility to add persons that he would so designate. So I think there, if he would like to add other departments or department chair, or I'm sorry, administrators or staff or what have you, cities, counties, or whomever, then that would be an appropriate spot for him to include that as well. And then also, you'll notice this council, in I believe this may be configured differently than the -1. Under the sub A, we were directing the council to meet quarterly to discuss topics related to economic development and improving the economy. The new portion is the sub B there, lines 14 through 20. So that this council would be directed to make recommendations to the legislature to help bring certainty to the development process in the state. It's a major concern that we've heard from business. And having certainty in the development process, I think, is something that is a key element of Oregon's land use planning system, as well as the other regulatory aspects of state government. Section 4 also is another change there. Really, right now, regions for the department really, I do not believe, are defined in any specific way. So the commission would be directed to establish regions for job development and community assistance, and that the regions would be drawn to effectively facilitate economic development. I believe that should help OECD to focus and assist the businesses in a more narrowly defined area in that regard, geographically speaking, or an area that made sense. Ms. Perini with the city of Gresham, I believe, who testified at the last hearing, I think was may have noted that in her comments, but that was definitely something that she noted to me in discussions that we had related to this issue. And I would just underscore one other thing, and that is, again, the prescriptive language that had been in the previous version of the amendments was taken out. And here I think the director still has great flexibility in determining what these regions are. Then another change was in what is sub 2 there in section 4, and rather than specifying that a individual at the department be or handle business innovations, that we would direct that the department handle economic innovation coordination, so that they can assist in making the connection between universities and business, which I believe tracks with legislation that was passed in, and I believe definitely the 2001 session on that regard. Skipping over to Section 5 is the local hiring component, which had been in the prior version of the bill. For strategic investment program areas, we're just encouraging businesses. As I understand it, that's basically all that we can do to require or to ask businesses that will be benefiting from that program to hire locally. Legislative Council, in drafting the bill with myself, noted that constitutionally we just cannot require that. So the thought here is that we would urge businesses to hire locally where they can. Section 7, skipping over to that for a moment, is really what I would say is one of the other major portions of the bill. And the language we had in the Dash 1 amendments on the Economic Ambassador Program has been blended with an existing statute on the field representatives. They're sometimes known as regional development officers. And this would be seen as a way to establish an advocate for business within government to help move projects along. Again, I believe Ms. Perini noted the or underscored the need for establishing a person like her doing what she does at the state level, and really that's kind of the idea here. The as I noted, we're changing an existing statute, which is noted here, ORS 285A.090. And in sub 2 is where you'll find that, where we've kind of merged the two languages together there. The field reps are to serve as internal advocates to help businesses move through the regulatory process. And that's been one of the things we've heard from business, is having to get through this huge maze of government regulations. And the thought here, the Economic Ambassador Program thought here, it would be envisioned here would be that the government representative would be helping the business, help guiding the business through that process to help move that economic development project along, rather than just saying, you know, okay, here you go, good luck. Now, because the professionals in these positions are who are making things happen might need some help on projects that might get bogged down unreasonably, as the language here is used, they would have the ability to seek assistance and direction from the governor or the governor's designee for resolving those delays. So we're kind of giving them some assistance there in case things get unreasonably bogged down. The field representatives also would be liaisons with between business and higher education institutions to assist in partnerships there. And they would be assembling rapid response teams, which I think could very much involve and go well with the community solutions team, for that matter, to help expedite projects. And finally, to continue their efforts on behalf of the department to work with local units of government and the private sector so that they're aware of the OECDD's programs and services. A lot of that language is, as you'll note, existing. Sections 6, 8, and 9 is the reporting elements of this bill, rather than quarterly, as was discussed in the Dash 1 amendments. We would be looking at asking them to file the reports annually. I understand that those reports are being filed annually anyway. So just in closing here, I think we've attempted to address concerns of the department, the issues raised by committee members at the last meeting on this bill, as well as others who've expressed concerns to me. Pat Egan in the governor's office, as well as the department, I believe you just heard from Mr. Brantley, have expressed that they're fine with the bill as amended. One minor change I would note, we would be asking that the bill be amended and moved to the floor, but to move because of where we're at here, but one change that we would be working on is, I think, a rather minor change, and that would be on page 3 of the bill, line 26, before the period there, the continuation of the word region, we would be asking for language so that the commission is setting these regions in consultation with local governmental units. So we appreciate your support, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Hines?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm still absorbing, so work with me as I'm still absorbing the dash twos and asking some questions. One of the things that had been suggested as a possible inclusion on the governor's council was somebody representing community colleges, I believe it was. I don't know if there was a specific thought of why not add that or not.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hunt. The thought on those council, if you look at who the persons are from those, well, really who those persons are, and those persons are the chairs of those commissions. They're not the administrators. Because the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development does not have a commission, as I understand it, that would be the reason. But I think also that would fit very nicely under the governor, including that person. I agreed with that. But I think the focus there was just getting the chairs of those various commissions and boards noted there involved with this particular area.
And along with that, I appreciate adding the chair of the ITC because I think that's a good logical addition. The one of the other issues that had come up, which is near and dear to me and I think central to the role of the department, is related to infrastructure issues, you know, their involvement with ports. I mean, obviously ODOT has a defined role, but obviously there's a clear OECD role in infrastructure development, and that I just kind of assumed that part of the rewritten mission statement would also include something along those lines. I don't know if you want to comment on why that's not in there.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hunt. Two areas I would point to on that. One is you look starting on page 1 of the bill, line 24, whereas discussing a healthy infrastructure, including ports, being critical to economic development, that you're absolutely correct. And that's one of the reasons I think that we changed that one mission statement item, adding what is now sub 5 of section 1 to deal with that issue, so that we're including that assistance that the department is providing to local economic development efforts, which would be that community development aspect of that.
So to answer your question?
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative March, you thought of one.
I did think of one. I went back and looked at my notes, Madam Chair. In section 1 of the dash ones, one of the issues that was raised by Ken Armstrong, I believe it was, talked about industrial and commercial infrastructure as maybe one of the possible areas that the department should work around and in. Do the dash twos sort of allow that or encourage that development of whatever infrastructure is necessary?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative March. I don't have the The dash ones are in my folder.
Right. Well, no, this it wasn't included in the dash ones, and that's why it was like something missing, and I wondered if it's you think it's covered here.
Yes, sir. I believe the element that you're referring to in the dash one was where that portion of the dash one amendments that was referring to what the central office shall do versus the regional offices, and that element has been completely taken out of this bill. And I believe that's where Mr. Armstrong had voiced a concern about that, because it was in the dash one language. I believe it discussed the central office shall have oversight over the regional offices, tourism, and I can't even remember the third one. And I think ports was the other area that he was looking to add to that. In terms of the infrastructure development, I believe that the issue of what the department does currently with respect to community development through their block grants, the Port Revolving Fund, and the other funds that they administer would be addressed in terms of what in terms of the mission statement portion now of the new Section 1 discussing the assistance to communities.
Right, and then Section 1, Sub 5, maybe providing assistance to communities.
Correct.
For local economic. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hass.
Thank you. I just have some questions about some of the phrases in here that feel a little loose. Like on page 6, Sub B, when a project has been unreasonably delayed by governmental action. How do we define unreasonably delayed? I mean, is it delay a day or is it a month? And, you know, what's unreasonable mean? I mean, somebody who doesn't like land use laws might think it's unreasonable to go through a process that has been set out in law by the government. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, I think that's a good question. And that is a good question. I'm not a lawyer, and
thank you.
I can't give you a legal response to that.
Well, I don't mean to. I mean, there's that one, and I also saw ensure client satisfaction. I'm not sure what that language means. Who's the client here, and how do we ensure satisfaction? I mean, I can't get no satisfaction. is what I'm saying, I guess, from the language. And a third one would be promote local awareness. Which I know what you're getting at and what you hope to do, but in my world, when you promote something, it usually involves sending out, some paid advertising or whatever it is. And if this has no fiscal impact, then I don't think that's not what you're talking about in advertising.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, that sub J is existing language. If you go to page 6, lines 17 through 19, that's the language right there. It's just we put that at the end of the of this.
Promoting local awareness.
Yes, that should be identical language that exists presently. In terms of your other two areas of concern, I think the idea here is more where you've got a project that is clearly it's held up for some reason, that I would think that the people that are in these positions are going to be in a position to know when it's time to bring in the governor or their person that they would designate for something like this. Other than that, I couldn't tell you if that's specifically defined in statute.
Well, Madam Chair, if I could follow up, I mean, sometimes there is a good reason to hold up a project. And I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, and I certainly know a lot of the stories about Columbia Sportswear and Applied Materials, and I know all those stories, but there may be a time when a project should necessarily be held up. And if we have some language in law that says something shouldn't be unreasonably delayed by governmental action, I just think it creates some confusion. I'm just wondering if maybe there's some better language.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, Yeah, we could probably, take out the term unreasonably, but then I would hate for that even a subjective term like delayed being out there. I think the issue that is trying to be addressed here, and I would think that, somebody who's involved with the land use planning system in the state, in the city of Kaiser, is, whether it's our land use planning system or business permitting process or code enforcement or what have you, I believe there's existing language in statute as well as administrative rules that say that projects need to proceed in some reasonable fashion that gets us to clear and objective standards as to how that project is going to proceed. And where you've got an unreasonable delay that is occurring for, I wouldn't want to speculate on that at this point. There's got to be some assistance that person can bring in from the state government to somehow resolve the issue and move it along somehow.
I appreciate that. I think a better way to get it. Permitting process is to do what we are doing to streamline the permitting process and to try and make our land use laws as flexible as possible and to get at it that way more so than some confusing language that says, we should try and not have unreasonable delays from our government. And in fact, government may have to delay for whatever reason.
Well, then I would think that they would be able to justify the delay in some respect then.
Thank you. That would be my thought, too, because unreasonable means there's got to be some reason. So to me, it makes perfect sense. I guess maybe I've been on the other side of that. I had a quick question on page 3, line 9, other persons designated by the governor. Is there any number?
Pardon me?
Any number that he could designate, or is that meant to be just wide open?
Madam Chair, I believe the thought there was to give the governor some flexibility in terms of bringing on who that person would wish to bring on, where you could bring on, say, the administrator for the community colleges department, other department staff, other commissions that may be out there.
Okay.
And just give him that flexibility.
Maybe following up on that question, and you've discussed this particular aspect with the governor's staff, and they have no problem. I mean, normally, when the governor has a governor's council, it's one he's just decided to do. So,
Madam Chair, Representative March, I just ran this language and sat down and talked with Pat Egan with the governor's office, and as amended, my understanding is they're fine with the bill.
Thank you. Representative Richardson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to commend Mr. Anderson and the work that you've done in these amendments, and they have resolved the concerns that I had previously. And I think that the idea of including a paragraph that would allow an appeal that would break through potential log jams that have caused the problems with which industry is daily confronted is a wise idea, and I certainly support this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jim Lindsay, does Mike want to come with you, or do you want to do this separate?
Perfect.
Do you want to testify together or separately?
Yeah, he's got a little different proposal or information.
Whatever you want to do.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, and the previous members of the committee here. My name is Jim Lindsay. I have a company called the Lindsay Group, and I work with the Manufacturers Assistance Program in Gresham, which is a program that's been running about 5 years. And our job is to work with the city and sometimes the county, and sometimes we do some work with the state to make it a little more user-friendly for manufacturing businesses in the Gresham area. And we've done a lot of things together. We've accomplished a lot of exchanges of information, and we've made things work a lot smoother out there, and we're very proud of that. I also have brought a couple of letters, which everybody has copies of. One is from Hiroshi Morihara and he's the head of the OSTP group in East County, which is trying to bring biotech and other industries into East County. And I also have a letter from Microchip Vice President Robert J. Lloyd expressing some of his feelings about House Bill 2011. My comments are kind of, as you can tell, I'm here because I'm in favor of the bill, but I just want to share a few other comments about things that I see in general that I don't know if they're things that can be added or looked at or language changed or whatever. And I just want to start off with a simple word. It's called productivity. And this is years ago I used to work in a company, and we used to have training sessions. And one of the training sessions I used to do had to do with a word called productivity. And I used to ask the people in the group, and I guess I'll ask you the same question, with you as people, in this group, in your life, what's the one most important thing in your whole life that affects your existence? And I won't ask you for an answer, but we used to get answers like my health, my family, my wife, my parents, you know, just all kinds of different answers that most of us would come up with. And I always challenged a group that said productivity was the most important thing in their lives. And they were always shocked when I said that. And when I was talking about productivity, I was talking about business productivity. And then I started to point out some simple things to them. The car you drive, the house you live in, the state of your health, even who you're married to, is greatly affected by the productivity of the society you're in. Whether you're living in a dirt hut or whether you're living in a nice house somewhere with heat and lights and air conditioning, all depend upon productivity, and it's productivity of business. So there's two things I'd like to see, if not in this bill, in some other bill, and that is I'd like to see someday that we make a goal for Oregon that says that Oregon will be the most productive state in the union, and that we'll work to see that that happens. And the other thing is that Oregon will have the highest per capita income of any state in the union. If we achieve the first one, we will achieve the second one. The bill, I think, helps keep things smart, simple, fast, and flexible. And if you ask me about any business that survives today in the tough business climate that we're dealing with internationally, those four things have to be there. You have to keep it simple. You have to be smart in what you're doing. You have to be fast and flexible. And you can't sit on your laurels, which is something we've all done from time to time, business-wise and state-wise. Many businesses today, many of the businesses we have in Oregon today will be the big businesses of tomorrow. There are a lot of innovative businesses already here that, given the proper climate, will grow and change and become, and this bill can help that. And I think that's an important part of this bill. It will help that occur. So there are, I'm sure, I could probably, if I were to take a look at some of the businesses in Portland or Oregon, you could probably pick 20 or 30 that someday may be very large businesses. Let's hope, unlike many other large businesses, they don't move their headquarters out of Oregon because it isn't a good place to be. Good example, Georgia Pacific, there's hundreds of them. Companies who for a long time were founded here, lived here, high-paid jobs, CEOs, vice presidents, and all the other things that go with headquarters, and they've mostly all moved out. And they moved out for a reason, because this is not a business-friendly state. It hasn't been for a while. This bill helps start to bring that back into focus, and I think that's very important. Let's see. One of the things we ought to do, too, by the way, is if you guys ever think about it, is ask some of these companies that left, why did you leave, and what do we need to get you back? It might be a good question to ask some companies, especially those that have left in the years that we've gone. Every time a bill comes up, another question to ask, and this bill is another one, does it effectively deal with the problems that we're trying to deal with here? In other words, if it's going to affect productivity in a negative manner, and I say this for every bill you pass, then ultimately it will affect Oregonians in a negative manner, and we'll be right back where we started from. I think we're all watching slowly California commit economic suicide. I don't think there's any question that's happening down there. We know that Oregon and Washington in some ways have moved down the same wrong path, and this bill is a movement back toward a little more reality and a little better situation for the state of Oregon. I've long since thought that if Oregon can get their economy moving again and do the things necessary to do that, we can own the West Coast, because California is not going to recover from what they're doing to themselves. And I don't see signs in Washington yet that they've figured it out. Oregon does have a chance to do this. and it would be wonderful for the state. And with the Pacific Rim being as big as it is, and only going to get bigger, do you realize what that means for the state of Oregon? Do you guys ever want to have a tax problem again or a budget problem again? You won't if you approach the problem correctly. So I guess I'm asking, no duct tape on the problems. Let's go at them. The bill is a good step. It's not the finish, but it's a good beginning. I think if we focus on our economy and start with this bill and continue forward, we will have powerful environment. And what I mean by that, it'll be a clean environment, and it'll be a strong business climate, and it will be achievable and sustainable. And that's the important part. Your environment, the quality of your life, all the things that we care about in this state will not improve or get better without the increase of productivity in the state. And that's why that's so important. And if you guys do follow this bill and make it happen, and then in the future, whatever you need to do, build on that, we can do this. And it will make a tremendous difference for the state. Great. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Lindsay?
Great. Appreciate it.
Yes, you did a great job. Thank you. Mike? Hard act to follow, huh?
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's very honor for me to be here first time as a testimony. I'm very excited when I hear about this kind of beer.
For the record, you need to state your name.
Yes, my name is Mike Son. Okay. Let me introduce myself. As Jim, he mentioned, I came up from California. Hmm. But he talked a lot about California. Yes, that's almost across the streets nowadays. Big trouble. Last year, I moved up here, opened a new business in Gresham area. Hmm. And I thought this is a good state and good environment for me to do something. And then eventually I'm making money here. So I started at the time. I thought it's very smooth. Everything will be going very well. But the first I faced a little bit the difficulties. For example, building permit or the business license, business registration is government, that kind of stuff. But I realized that the this kind of the government and private sector organization as a one team, for me, is a lot of saving the money. And I'm very pleased and support this kind of bill, and I want to extend my business here further. For example, like I have a lot of ideas. A lot of my friends in California, Silicon Valley, not the high-tech products, but they are very scared coming out here. What can we do? What kind of incentives is here? But I did. Now I have to be successful here. And then let them know, see, I'm successful. A lot of support from local people. And a lot of infrastructures here, and the manpower's here. You know that a lot of Oregon University people, they educated here. Everybody voluntarily going out the other states because no job here. I like to buy Oregon brain people and want to using their technology, their any some brain ideas and share with me. This morning, that's the reason I had a good meeting with OHSU people. And then I want to share already their given utilities. If I want to put my money again, like where I get the return, that kind of stuff immediately. They have already enough well-organized facilities there. I want to use it. So I want to work together with educational people and then government people together. That will be a good chance for me surviving here. And then contribution to these communities. I'd like to share with you, and then please pass this bill.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Mark.
Yes, thank you. It's real pleasant to see someone who's moved to Oregon for business. And could I ask, one, what kind of business and what drew you to Oregon? Was it the brain power available?
Thank you, Representative Mark. My business is a high-tech-related business. Right now, all high-tech business, for example, semiconductor industries, already more than 3 years, everybody's bad. My business was in Silicon Valley, high-tech-related semiconductor parts cleaning business. The economy is so bad, nobody want to buy or invest any capital money. So I want to recycling that kind of existing equipment or any parts. That's my business. But that high-tech industry in this area, maybe, Chair, Madam, you already knew that everybody almost selling here. They want to move out to overseas because no more competition. The competitiveness here. That's the real story. The decision is that high-tech industry is not always good. Yes, sometimes it's good, but sometimes it's bad because cycle up and down, up and down. So I want to focus on the other industry, this kind of my high-tech technology cleaning business for medical, food industry, the other that kind of study. You have many kind of here. It's possible. That's my contribution to this industry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Nelson?
He's actually on the point of view. You can go down the bottom.
Well, there's one other one, John Chandler. That might take a while.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler with Legislative Advocates and several clients with a great deal of interest in this bill. And I'll be very brief. Really appreciate the testimony you took the other day. Appreciate Mr. Anderson's hard work in pulling the bill together and the Dash 2 amendments. I'm very pleased with what you've got in front of you. I commend it to you. I think it's a good adjunct to the various other pieces of legislation that are going through this process on industrial lands, on permitting reform, on agency rules, and that sort of thing. And I think they've really done a good job in recognizing how this dovetails in with the other pieces. So that's all I've got. Thank you very much. It's a good bill.
Any questions?
Well, we might as well drag this out.
Yeah.
Why not? Why wouldn't you?
We're waiting for Mr. Nelson to come. See.
No.
Well, what I wanted to clarify, John, is last time you were here, you spoke about a different bill moving on the Senate that you'd been working on very vociferously, and in its newly reconstructed form, this will mesh with the work that you've been done on the other side.
Madam Chair, Representative March, I believe so, yes. It actually matches, I think, with several bills. There's the series of bills that were in the House Committee this morning, 710 through 714, on building permits and inspections and such as that, building code stuff. The one I was referencing, Representative March, is Senate Bill 467 on industrial land, which is down in Ways and Means right now. There's House Bill 3120, which will be on the floor later, dealing with agency rules and the governor's office of streamlining. I think what you have now is a bill that will fit with those and provide, and frankly, provide a tool with this. I keep wanting to call them ambassadors because I think that's a cooler name than field reps, but and they might get a hat or something out of the deal, which would be kind of slick. But one of the sideways ones, I think those are cool, but that's just me. This function that the 2011 is talking about, I think fits into the Community Solutions Office that we put in 467 and the agency to agency and now agency to business and local government to help actually. And I think Representative Haas made a good point that not all delays are unreasonable. Most are, but not all. But where there is a sticking point, having someone, I think the signal we're sending with this bill and with the others is not that the delays are good, bad, or indifferent, but that the state of Oregon, the government of Oregon, the local government, believe in helping people through them. Not that the regs go away, but that people aren't just stymied and cul-de-sacked and trying to figure out how to get through them. So I think it ties in very nicely. And I think Mr. Anderson did an excellent job and a lot of work in a few days seeing where those other pieces were and pulling them all into a package.
Well, I just want to make sure I didn't want to get crosswise with you on this bill by supporting the last version. And I think the definition of unreasonable is when your project's delayed, it's not unreasonable. When mine is, it is.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Chandler? Seeing none, thank you very much. Mr. Nelson sent a note that he would forego his testimony because his questions or his comments had already been addressed. Is there anyone else here that has? Doris, do you want to come forward?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Doris Penwell from Economic and Community Development Department. I think Representative Haas has raised some issues that we might be able to deal with in regard to the sort of strange language that is in this version of the bill. And we could say the same kind of thing, but be a little more positive or not quite so negative about the delays and whatever. So I think Bruce Anderson and I could work with Representative Haas and others to see if we could clean up the language when at another place in this process, maybe in Ways and Means even.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
That's about all I'd like to say, and we support the bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else wants to testify? I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 2001, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2001. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move the dash to amendments to House Bill 2001.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos has moved the dash to amendments to House Bill 2011. Any questions? Any comments?
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Haas.
I just want to say for the record that I really do support the intent of this. But if we're going to do economic development in the state, I think I don't think economic development is passing a bill that says, no, we really, really want to do economic development. I think it is funding a transportation package, funding our higher ed system that works hand in hand with the private sector, and funding our schools so that we can stay out of the New York Times. And because I think the message we're sending on an economic development platform for the rest of the country now is a state that can't afford to pay for its schools, and that's a terrible economic development message. So, and while I support the intent of this, I just don't see any action here other than rearrange furniture and restate a mission statement. So, for that reason, I think I'm going to oppose this just because I'd rather do something that is like real economic development as opposed to just words say, no, we really mean it this time.
I duly noted. Our motion is on the dash two amendments, so I assume we'll do the vote on that, and then we'll do the vote on the House bill. I might want to add that part of the reason we can't fund the higher education and we have problems with all these things is because we don't deal with the very reason that this bill will do, and that is streamline our process and make it easier for businesses to come here. So I guess that's the counter to it, and I, too, would like to do all the things that you're saying. Any objections to the dash two? So ordered. Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2011 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. I have a motion. Thank you. To move House Bill 2001 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Hunt.
That's why she's the vice chair to back you up on
that. That is perfect. She's awesome.
That was not my comment, though.
That was it. You're done.
I don't think I have a problem with anything that doesn't sound like it may be changed. I just don't see how this doesn't have, based on the definition we've been using of fiscal impact in other bills, I just don't see how this doesn't have some fiscal impact and why we wouldn't be saying it to Ways and Means. I'd be happy to support it, saying it to Ways and Means. I just don't see how we can send it to the floor when, at least as we've been interpreting every other bill, this has a parallel kind of fiscal impact.
And
it says right on the the staff measure summary may have fiscal impact, but no statement issued yet.
Well, to answer that, Representative Hunt, and I'll have Kim follow up if I don't answer this correctly, but there may be a fiscal, but because of the time element that we're facing, we need to get this to the floor, and the fiscal will be done there, so, or by the time we get it to the floor. So there would be a fiscal impact if statement issued.
Yeah, I guess if I could.
Sure.
If I could just respond.
Of course.
I think that could be said with a lot of the things that are in Ways and Means right now that are not being sent to the floor. So I just don't see how this is is different in that respect.
Okay. Any other comments? All right. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hess?
No.
Representative Hunt?
Nope.
Representative Marsh?
Aye.
Representative Richardson?
Aye.
Representative Gallegos?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Chair Smith?
Aye. Motion carries. Close the work session on House Bill 2001. And Representative Gallegos, would you like to carry this bill?
We have to.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos will be the carrier. Thank you very much. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3.7. Do you want, Representative Richardson, since this is your bill, do you want to go down to the dais? Do we want to let him tell
us
about it?
He's been meeting me.
Okay.
You might want to ask him if you'd like James Adams.
Would you like James Adams to accompany you?
Yes, please.
Welcome. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3547A represents amendments that encourage the development of Oregon as a center of excellence on homeland security, knowledge, training, and products. To set the foundation for this opportunity, which is to establish a new economic industry and a cluster of industries for Oregon in the area of homeland security, I'd like to introduce you to James Adams, who is uniquely qualified to inform us on the war on terrorism, its possible impact on Oregon, and homeland security opportunities for Oregon. Mr. Adams is a former CEO of United Press International and a former managing editor of the London Sunday Times. He regularly commutes to Washington, D.C., where he serves as a consultant on terrorism to the various intelligence agencies there. He was the founder, chairman, and CEO for iDefense, which is the world's first cyber intelligence organization with clients in the intelligence industry, the government, and Fortune 100 companies. He's a senior fellow at the Center of Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in globalization, intelligence, cybersecurity, and homeland defense. He's the author of 13 books. The most recent one is called The Next World War, and it deals with cyber terrorism, and it's one that I'm presently reading, and it's fascinating. And he lives in Ashland with his two daughters. He commutes regularly from Ashland to Washington, D.C., and he's the chairman and CEO of the Ashland Institute of Strategic Studies. And so with that, I'm hoping that he would take some time to bring us up to speed on what is happening on the war on terrorism in our nation, how it's affecting us because of his unique knowledge, and then also to discuss with us how that might affect Oregon and economic opportunities in this area for Oregon.
Okay.
How much time could we have him take?
Probably 20 minutes would be top.
So I can cover the world in 20 minutes.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, good afternoon, and thank you all very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today, and thank you to Dennis for making this possible. I thought that what I would try to do is to give you a sense of where the war on terrorism is, how it's been going, and where I think it's going to go. And I bring three different things to this table, I guess. The first is that I've been specializing in warfare for about 25 years, particularly with terrorism and intelligence. Second, I've been in Washington, D.C. since 9/11 a great deal, both dealing with the war on terrorism and in trying to set strategy for the war, that war and the war with Iraq. And third, I'm an Oregon citizen now, and I'm a professor at Oregon State University, and I have a close interest in the future of this state. You will recall, all recall, I'm sure, 9/11, and that was a culmination of a series of events that began with the bombing of embassies in Africa, and then the attack on the USS Cole, and then the deaths in New York City and in Washington, D.C. The third plane that went down in Pennsylvania was designed to take out the Congress of the United States. What we learned from those attacks were that they are international in nature, organized from a country far away, an attack taking place in another country far away, a different country. Second, that they are coordinated brilliantly, diverse people, some of whom have never met before, coordinated to come to a particular place at a particular time and to carry out a very creative attack. Each of the attacks that took place had not been foreseen. We had no idea at all that the 9/11 attacks would take the form that they took. And what that tells us in the longer term is that this is a new enemy, thinking about things very differently and how they can attack us, exploiting our weaknesses. What we saw in response to that was an immense intelligence effort trying to discover the perpetrators, and that was very swiftly done through intercepts. And we also focused our energies at home in how best to defend the homeland. We learned a great deal about what we didn't know. We learned that there were tens of thousands of members of Al-Qaeda. We learned that they were in about 60 countries. We did not learn the identities of most of them. We did not learn what their future plans were. We learned that they planned to attack us. We learned from intercepts that they talked about massive destruction of the United States. They talked about economic devastation. They talked about forcing America to withdraw its troops from overseas countries. So we knew that they planned more, but we didn't know who or what or when. Our first point of response was Afghanistan, to try to take out the safe haven that Al-Qaeda had used both for training and for logistics. That was successful. We demonstrated considerable technological prowess. We destroyed the government, and we have put in place a different government of a very different complexion. But we managed in that exercise and others that have followed to take out about a quarter of the Al-Qaeda strength. So that leaves three quarters still functioning. We have arrested a large number of people, both here and overseas, but we recognize that there are several hundred Al-Qaeda members still operating in the United States. We also missed the leader, bin Laden. He's still alive, he's active, but he learned a lot from our technological capabilities that we demonstrated in Afghanistan, and he's adapted his tactics accordingly. We then moved our eyes onto Iraq, and we gave three reasons for attacking Iraq. One, they were a clear and present danger. Two, they had relationships with Al-Qaeda. And three, they had programs of weapons of mass destruction that broke down into nuclear, chemical, and biological. Iraq, in my judgment, was not a clear and present danger. They had no effective links with Al-Qaeda. They did not have an active nuclear weapons program, but they did have active chemical and biological weapons. For political reasons, we have pursued the Iraq option with the results that we have seen. And while that was unfolding and negotiations were going on in the United Nations and elsewhere, a great deal of effort in the intelligence community was expended in trying to understand the threat presented by chemical and biological weapons. The result for our political leaders was very frightening indeed. We recognized for the first time that large numbers of countries either have or are acquiring biological weapons, that a single attack on the United States using a very small amount could kill millions of Americans. Millions, this is, not just a few thousand, as died on 9/11. There was an exercise 2 years ago that modeled what would happen if smallpox was released in the Midwest, a very small amount. Within 3 months, 3 million Americans were dead, 4 million were dying. Every state in the Union had deployed National Guard on its borders to prevent refugee flows within the United States. This was very frightening for politicians to read about, and to realize that from information that we discovered from terrorists, both their computers and from interrogations, that they have actively been attempting to acquire biological weapons. Some believe they already have them, others are less certain. But it is clear that the bar has been raised, and the expectation is that attacks will occur either from Al-Qaeda or others using biological weapons. And there is complete certainty, not a shadow of doubt, in the minds of any of those involved in this counterterrorism war that another attack on U.S. soil will occur. The question is how large that attack and how many will die. What we have seen in the war in Iraq is that the fighting itself, the war plan, went very well. It did, contrary to what you read in some of the media, go exactly as planned, pretty much, uniquely for a war plan. What is not going well is the peace, and that was always going to be the significant challenge. We risk becoming the true enemy in Iraq, and an enemy that does not behave as Saddam Hussein behaved. And what history tells us is that we will become the target, and it will become a very challenging exercise for us. But we learned something else in Iraq, I think, and that is that any nation that challenges us will, on our terms, will be destroyed. We have such technological mastery and such overwhelming force superiority that no nation would sensibly take us on. What that means to me is that nations or individuals or groups who do not like the United States or what the United States stands for will choose war by other means. And they will choose to attack us not using the weapons of our choice, but the weapons of their choice. And what they've seen from what Al-Qaeda has done is that you can have tremendous effect, enormous impact, by actually doing not very much. And that, to me, means that the war we've seen in Iraq is the last war that we will fight, that we choose to fight in the way that we want to fight it and win it. And instead, we are going to be attacked by others who will choose to wage war using their weapons at their time and at their place of their choosing. So as we move forward, what we see, I think, is that we have a very different world. We have a threat against us which is can be broadly broken down into three different areas. The first is conventional weapons. Terrorists have, for 50 years or so, have used assassination, bombing, as a routine tool. What we've seen with Al-Qaeda is that they've upped the ante. It's a different world now. For the first time, we as a nation are confronting the concept of a nuclear attack. Twice in the last 2 years, we have been certain that a nuclear attack, first was a nuclear and the second was a radiological attack, was going to happen in America. And I was flying through, during one of them, I was flying in and out of D.C. And it was very strange. I've seen a great deal of war in my time. And flying into D.C., leaving Ashland, not knowing if I was going to come home, and then leaving D.C., not knowing if I was ever going to see the city again. That's a very, very different world that we have today than we had 5 years ago. But nuclear is not actually the most likely form of attack, because nuclear weapons are very expensive. They're very difficult to get. We spend a lot of time tracking nuclear devices, and the non-proliferation regime has actually been quite successful. Chemical and biological weapons, on the other hand, are much, much easier. I can make enough biological weapons in a room this size to kill the whole population of the United States. So it's much more difficult to track. It's much easier to make. It's very inexpensive. The raw materials are accessible. So that is a more likely avenue, I would have thought, as well as the more conventional attacks. So what have we done about this new challenge? We've created a Department of Homeland Security. We have thrown an enormous amount of money at this problem, increased the defense budget for the first time in many years. We have given $40 billion a year in budget to the Department of Homeland Security, an enormous new bureaucracy. A great deal more money has been given to the intelligence community. But what we haven't seen, in my view, is what this challenge requires, which is a different approach, leaner, more flexible, exactly the kind of thing that you in Oregon are trying to create for the business community, something that's agile, something that's able to meet the current needs. And instead, when 3,000 people died in the World Trade Center, not a single individual in any branch of government was held accountable. Not one. So what does that show to those who wish us ill? It suggests that we don't learn our lessons very well. It suggests that we do what we have always done, which is to apply mass to a problem and money and believe that that is going to fix the challenge. But that, is, as a problem set, presents, I think, a really unique opportunity for the state of Oregon. I've spent some time traveling around in the last few months to various organizational meetings. I've met with folks at the university. And what I see is a very fragmented approach to an opportunity that exists for the state. What is happening in Washington is that there is more money than has ever occurred for any single problem that is being made available to anyone who has the capabilities and the clearly developed plan to try and acquire that cash. This is grant money. The feds want to give it. They can't find enough people who want it and who can articulate how it's going to be spent that will serve the nation. What we have as a state is a very strong public sector with the universities and colleges. We have a very strong private sector, a lot of it very high technology. We have no coordinated way to attack this as I would attack a business problem as a CEO. I would see a market opportunity. I would meet with those who complemented my weaknesses. And I would create a business plan against which I would execute to ensure that I grab market share. What instead we have is the public sector doing the best it can, and that's all well and good. You have the private sector that is very diffused. There is no coherent and common approach. There are some self-interested specialist groups around, and that's fine. But it doesn't make for a coordinated, focused effort to execute against a plan. And I believe that what we are seeing with Homeland Security is the creation of a new multi-billion dollar industry. We are going to be at war for the next 50 years. We are going to be attacked again and again and again. The money that is going to come at this problem will increase, and it will be with us certainly for the rest of our lives. So that suggests at a time when none of this is sorted out, the Department of Homeland Security is in chaos, the government itself hasn't got a strategic vision, so if a group can come towards the government and say, this is what we think can be done, and do it in this way, and here is our plan, I think that will be a very compelling case. And so what I would like to see the state do is to create a public-private partnership, bring together a small group of excellence that would create this business plan, that would have clear goals and objectives, that would include what money we expect to bring home to the state of Oregon, and how many jobs that in turn will create. And thus, for the public sector at the universities, instead of being in defense and cut, which is all they seem to be able to think about, instead there is an opportunity to grow out of the problem, create more jobs and opportunities, develop Oregon as a center of excellence for homeland security. And that, I believe, would be very good for the public sector and very good for the private sector and very good for the state of Oregon. Thanks.
Oh, thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Adams? Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, you talk about the federal money that's available, but you know, my understanding is that majority of it would require state put up some money and then it's federal matching, you know, some variety. But, and that's what I'd like to hear. What portion of grants are available without, since clearly...
There's a lot, and not just from the Department of Homeland Security. They are seeking... they're seeking those $800 and some million devoted to research, for example, infrastructure. There is, and these are not all funds that are necessarily matching. And it's not just the Department of Homeland Security. There's a lot of money in the intelligence community, a great deal of money in commerce, customs, and so on. So, yes, you're right that there is state matching, but that's a decision that the state would make on a cost-benefit analysis, where if you're getting $5 million from the feds, do you match with $5 million, and does that create sufficient? You know, there's an easy equation to make there. I think that what would make sense to me is to, if you had a group of CEOs or whatever, and the relevant state folks, and you identify all the money that is available, what is required to have state funding and what is independent funding, what do you think we can go after, because there's a compelling case both either through an alliance between a university and a private sector company or whatever it might be, but that is all part of developing a plan. And if you're going to get market share, you want to have a very clear picture about what there is. What I've seen of what the state says there is and what I hear in Washington are different things. What I don't know is what ground truth is, because I've never seen anybody that's done the work, and I've not seen any other state that has come up with the sort of concept that I'm talking about. There's people, Virginia for example, working at stuff, but the opportunity is, this is all a greenfield really, and no one knows the answers, so I think we can push to create them.
Thanks. Thank you. Representative March?
Well, thank you. Professor Adams, I certainly agree with your points about our being in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think we're in a morass there. What kind of entities do you see as working on this? What kind of organizations out there in the private sector would we anticipate working together on this?
Well, I would think that you probably want to have, I mean, Oregon has got a lot of decent companies, Intel, HP, a bunch of other folks. And in the initial phase, what you're trying to do is to scope out the problem and then see what goals and objectives can be set that can be executed and people held accountable for. Part of that process is to say, you get on your small group of half a dozen or a dozen or something, and they're all people who have led and done as opposed to who aspire to do any of those things. And then you deliver a plan, and in that plan is identified exactly what you say. Here are 50 high technology companies that produce the following things. This is why it's relevant to Homeland Security and where they can add value and what their competition looks like. And out of that then says, all right, we're going to pursue microwave security. Well, here are five companies, and if we're going to do a cluster around that, there's some interesting research going on over here in this university, let's bond those together, and we'll pitch for this contract in point X. So with that kind of, it only can work, this, as a public-private partnership, I think, because the self-interested business folks will only go for what they're interested in, obviously. And the state needs to do what's right for the state, and the feds need to know that the state is and the private sector are working together. But my argument, I guess, is that I don't know the answer to a lot of these things. I can just see this very big opportunity sitting out there, this huge thing known as Homeland Security. And even the Department of Homeland Security doesn't know what it's doing. So this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity that we can take advantage of.
I think we could pass that bill immediately. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Richardson, did you have any other comments on your Dash 2 amendments?
Madam Chair and colleagues, only to just kind of conclude with the idea that what we have is an opportunity that nobody asked for us to be in the situation in which we find ourselves as a nation, but it is real. And if we are aware of that, and that there is going to be a tremendous need for research and for development of products to help solve these problems that the nation faces, then why shouldn't Oregon immediately look at whether or not we can develop that kind of a plan and move ahead into this opportunity before it gets co-opted by other areas? We're looking for economic development and economic opportunities, and here's one that hasn't been already taken by California or Virginia or Maryland or any other state. And so we have the research capabilities and the money that's been going to OHSU and others promoting research. We have the technological companies, and we have the desire and the need. And so this is an opportunity for us to focus on the organization to do that. And this is a very brief bill, and it basically gives us a platform on which to pursue to do this.
Thank you very much. Representative Gagos.
Thank you. Can you pronounce that well?
You're learning.
Representative Richardson. Are you thinking then that some of the money that we're already investing in our universities can be tied to that are in the research realm, and that that can be used as matching dollars since we don't have additional funds to throw at right now? I mean, that's what I thought you said.
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I'm not saying that because I don't have any knowledge of it. I know that we need to determine what it's going to take for us to go back to Washington and say, here's a plan, here's what we can do, and we would like to have your participation. I don't think that we immediately go for matching dollars because of the revenue situation we find ourselves, but we go for dollars that are available from the federal government to promote the research and the products. And then if matching dollars with university money becomes a factor, that's, you know, we'd work that out with the universities, but that there's no fiscal on what we're trying to accomplish here.
No, I just wanted clarity on that one. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Adams, for making the trip, and we appreciate it. We have one person, Sherry Shang, who would like to comment on this bill.
Hi, welcome.
We have a few minutes left. So.
Great.
Great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sherry Shang with Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, wanted to take a brief moment and provide a highlight summary of some of the things that the department has been doing in the areas of working with Homeland Security companies. As you know, we never want to miss an opportunity to tell what we have been accomplishing. So in general, the department, after 9/11, recognized Homeland Security may be an area of significant growth and felt we need to explore the opportunities by working with Oregon companies. In December of 2001, we brought together 40-some individuals representing 20-some companies from Oregon, and these are companies that are involved in the security industry, many of them with expertise in cybersecurity. Out of that meeting, an organization, a nonprofit called Oregon Reigns, was spawned, and that organization has received some support from the department. And while they focused quite a bit of their work in the cybersecurity area, a lot of what they have done is bringing together companies with an interest in Homeland Security. And through the department's effort, we connected them with the Oregon University System, with the State of Oregon, and with other federal agencies. So the department has since been playing the role of the convener, bringing together both industry interest and public interest in order to achieve a collaboration. And I think what has been most exciting has been this public-private partnership has gotten the attention of all the way up to the White House. We met with Vice President Cheney and had an opportunity to talk to him about this project. And since then, I know he has been talking to other people about this Oregon Reigns project as an example of a prototype of how local people can get organized. So I think a lot of the ideas presented here are very good. Just want to assure you that we have not been asleep. In fact, we have recognized the opportunity and have been taking some fledgling steps toward realizing the opportunity. I think that really the limitations are, one, we have to have interested companies with the right products that are willing to work together. We have seen some of that, and we're working toward achieving more. two, we have engaged all of the Oregon University campuses in this effort, working with companies toward a shared project, and all eight campuses participated in identifying what their expertise is, what their interest is, and potentially what kind of projects that they can participate in. So we're very excited about that. And I think the third thing is it takes opportunity, it takes the right interest, but we have to be opportunistic, because one thing that we have recognized is, as Professor Adams had identified, companies have to be interested if the opportunity that they perceive has to match with what their interest is. And in our baby step efforts toward bringing companies together and developing this cluster, it was very clear there is a great deal of concern about confidentiality, about sharing company secrets, about potential competitiveness in developing sales opportunities. However, because of the department's participation, there has been a broader public interest consistently communicated, and I think that has facilitated some of the effort. This effort now does have the sponsorship of Oregon's congressional delegation. We have done a couple of trade missions to Washington, D.C., talking with federal agencies that are in positions of procuring these services, and most recently had high officials from NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, that has a great deal of the research dollars that Professor Adams referred to, as well as the Department of Defense, that has a great deal of the appropriated funds for these projects, out in Oregon visiting with companies and sharing the latest with Oregon company representatives. That concludes my brief summary. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for Sherry? Representative Berger?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the efforts so far, would you be affirming to Professor Adams' remarks about the federal money that might be pouring into these kinds of efforts, and is Oregon positioned to see any of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I think Oregon is fairly well positioned. However, Oregon's companies, through our recent experience, are not the huge players. They are the medium-sized companies in the homeland security industry. And so we have always believed, in order for Oregon to be successful, it takes a collaboration of lots of companies working together, as opposed to a single company having the great depth and the capabilities to make it on its own. I think our strategy has been successful. However, the monies have not been forthcoming, even though there have been a lot of monies in bills, they have not been actually appropriated. Many of these bills have been held up, and so we continue to work at it, but it certainly has not been as easy and promising as I think a lot of people had envisioned initially.
Sure.
I'm sorry, what about the university system and that piece, the research piece? Have you explored that at all?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, we have explored the research piece. In fact, Portland State University is in the, I would say, fairly ahead in their work related to security, especially cybersecurity, because they've had a head start. Many of our other campuses, including Oregon State University and University of Oregon and Southern Oregon University, each have its expertise in that area. There definitely is potential, but in terms of actually tapping into the research dollars, our research has shown National Science Foundation and National Institute for Standards and Technology are the two significant potential funding sources. We just had the NIST head for research in Portland, in Oregon, visiting with universities and companies in March. And she loved what she saw, but her remark is, I don't have money available right now. As soon as I get my appropriation, you know, you're very early on in the list. So we're very encouraged.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3547. and committee. I'm not sure when we're going to be meeting again. We're trying to close down the House committees on next week. Do you have something, Representative Hass, you'd like to say?
Before I close out, I just wanted to serve notice of a possible minority report on House Bill 2011.
Duly noted. Guess I haven't had that happen before. So. Good way to end it. Is there another person that does that? It takes two.
Takes two. Yeah, they had it. Two no's.
Yep. Representative Hunt, thank you very much.
Those naysayers.
It's
not a bad thing. It's just a part of our democratic process.
It certainly is. It certainly is. And I should have hit that gavel sooner. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. I know you. I'm just kidding. I want to tell you, committee, how much I've enjoyed working with you. And it seems like it's gone very quickly. And maybe it seems at times that we haven't done a whole lot on this committee, but I certainly appreciate all of your expertise and efforts, and I have something I want to give to you, and it's not my outfit.
Are you really?
No.
Well, that's such a fun committee.
I thought it was appropriate, and I have a note for everybody.
Oh, my goodness.
Is it a little miniature of an abandoned mill site?
Yes.
You can get her own site.
It is a token of my appreciation. This is a
Isn't that nice?
I have one for everyone.
Well, thank you, Minister.
So I thank you so much. You have an amazing chair. It's easy to be a chair.
Yeah, I figured we had a few more meetings.
Well, we might have, and at this point, nothing's been assigned to us.
Because Steve really wanted to do a minority report.
No, I wanted.
I mean, normally we get together, and the members, committee members, get together. And
I think with that, I'm going to adjourn the committee for today.